Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. And happy Turkey Day, everybody. We really appreciate you joining us on Thanksgiving. Now, food is essential to this holiday, and we'll have a mouth-watering conversation with Chef Bryant Terry later in the hour. But for many people in the U.S., you also can't have Thanksgiving without football. And the tensions between football as pure entertainment and football as a platform for activism have been on full display in recent years.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for: freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
That's Colin Kaepernick in 2016. He's speaking to reporters in a locker room interview following the first game when he chose to sit rather than stand while the national anthem played. Much has changed in the 5 years since this moment. Kaepernick is no longer playing in the NFL, shut out by what seems to be a collusion among the professional teams. But Colin Kaepernick's choice to take a knee made him so much more than a quarterback. It transformed him into a catalyst for meaningful social discourse and change. And during the past 5 years, thousands of athletes have elevated their fields of play into platforms for change as well. These athlete activists kneel in the same tradition that the 1968 Olympic medalists Tommy Smith and John Carlos stood.
The United States leads the Olympics in medal awards and is just about supreme in the sprint races, thanks to men like Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Yesterday, they came in first and third in the 200-meter dash, and then stood on the victory platform with bowed heads, wearing black socks and gloves in a racial protest.
Colin Kaepernick's silent protest was soon repeated by athletes from all sports, from many racial backgrounds, and from grade school to the professional leagues.
U.S. soccer star Megan Rapinoe decided to take a knee during the national anthem last night in a friendly match against Thailand.
Wisconsin high school football players are joining the protest started by San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick.
Players from Madison East High School and Madison West High School took a knee during the pregame national anthem on Friday night. School administrators say that they support the students.
Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, talked with dozens of these brave athletes for his latest book, The Kaepernick Effect: Taking a Knee, Changing the World. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and on today's episode of The Takeaway, we're kicking off by revisiting our in-depth conversation about this book with its author, Dave Zirin.
For the young people with whom I spoke, taking the knee is about a language. It's about a method. It's about a way to show their community that they are upset about racial inequity and police brutality. That's what it is in its most broad form. Now, they could be doing it because of a local incident. They could be doing it because the memory of people like Philando Castile and Alton Sterling and Sandra Bland just falls heavily upon their shoulders and they want to express that. But for whatever the individual motivation, most broadly, it's because when Colin Kaepernick took that knee, it showed these young athletes that there was something that they could do. And so they just, you know, pardon the mixed sports metaphor, but they just took the baton and ran with it.
So tell us one story, one athlete, one town that has stuck with you most after having completed the book.
It's almost tough to try to think of one, only because these young people were so open with me, and it's like choosing one almost feels like playing favorites because I've got such incredible reservoirs of affection for all the people with whom I spoke. We've stayed in contact. I went back and re-interviewed just about everybody after the police murder of George Floyd and the demonstrations broke out in the summer of 2020 to see how they were feeling about that. So, you know, there are layers here of connection that I want to honor. But at the same time, when you ask the question, it's difficult for me not to think about somebody like Rodney Axon Jr., who's the very first story in the book. By my calculations and research, Rodney Axon was the first person in this country after Colin Kaepernick to put their knee on the ground. So of all the women, men, young boys, young girls, different sports, it actually started with a football player in Brunswick, Ohio. And that's Rodney Axon. That's a suburb of Cleveland. And Rodney Axon felt like he had no choice but to take that knee because he had been just filled with just a lot of anger and dissatisfaction because there was a ton of racism on the football team. Here he was. His family had moved him out of Cleveland to a predominantly white suburb and school in Brunswick because they thought the family would be safer there and get a better education. And far from feeling safe, he is confronted with racism, with police harassment, and just feeling like a fish out of water. And so for him, it was like, what am I doing here? Why is this happening to me? Why is this my existence? And he was searching for some way just to show everybody that racism was not okay in Brunswick, and he was tired of having to bear the brunt of it. So I think of Rodney a lot because, to me, it's evocative of the courage that so many people in the book show, and so evocative also of the lack of regret or remorse about what they did.
You touch on another key aspect as you were telling us his story. In the book, you write both about athletes who took this knee, took this stand, made this statement as solo actors, often because they had to be, right? But then there are also times when it's the whole team, when the team makes a decision together to stand, to kneel, to be in solidarity. Tell us a little bit about, one, how that happens, how it is that some teams made that whole decision, and then also what difference it makes when the whole team is part of it.
You know, Melissa, I have a good friend named Joe Ehrman, and he played for the old Baltimore Colts, and he does coaching seminars. And Joe has this thing that he says, where he says, there are two kinds of coaches, the transactional and the transformational. And the transactional coach is the person who is in it for themselves and for how coaching young people makes them feel and how winning makes them feel and their own status in a community because of the actions of children. And that, unfortunately, is that unflattering description describes, I would argue, most youth coaches in this country. The transformational coach is the person who's in it for the kids, who's in it for their, who sees themselves as an educator and is in this to educate the kids themselves. In situations where you have transformational as opposed to transactional coaches, only there do you see the whole team really come together and turn it into from an act of a single person who can be isolated, who can be scapegoated, who can be attacked, and you turn it into almost like an I am Spartacus moment where everybody is saying, you know what, if you come after one of us, you're coming after all of us. And they take the rhetoric, the sometimes very thin rhetoric about a sports team being like a family, and they take that very seriously. So if one person in the family is upset, everybody should be upset. If one person has an issue, then everybody has an issue. And what the coach does is he or she or they do not just snap their fingers and say, let's have a team meeting and talk about racism, but they actually artfully and skillfully facilitate a conversation that allows for true empathy and true solidarity.
How did the team protest of the Missouri football team happen?
That's just a remarkable story. The Missouri football team made history in a way that I think sent shockwaves of fear down the spines of every college president in the United States. And to me, it's like I still go back to it sometimes and shudder with joy.
That's how I felt. I was like, yes, I've been waiting for this moment in college sports.
I know. And that was, let's remember, that was in 2015, November. Colin Kaepernick is August of 2016. Mm-hmm. So the power of the athlete was already, we forget this sometimes, was strongly in the air by the time Colin Kaepernick decided to take his knee. What made Colin Kaepernick different and what made him, I think, historically very significant was using that anthem space by which to express his dissent, which then spread like wildfire, which I express in the book, and the power of the symbolism of taking that knee. That's a specific language Colin Kaepernick gave, but it's not the ultimate expression of power that we've seen. And the ultimate expression of power is first seen in that Missouri football team in, I believe it was November of 2015. And in brief order, this story, the University of Missouri, I mean, Missouri has such a legacy of racism, both as a state, but also on that campus, that goes back decades. This has been a Missouri issue for decades of students, particularly black and brown students, of saying, we have a problem here. And it needs to be addressed, and having their concerns fall upon uncaring ears. And after a series of incidents, of violent incidents on campus, incidents that involved also racist graffiti on campus, some students decided that enough was enough. And so they started to engage in regular civil disobedience, hunger strikes, very influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement. Missouri is a very short distance, although another world, from Ferguson, Missouri, and several students started doing the drive to Ferguson to be part of the protests and breaking that kind of invisible wall between this institution of higher learning and this impoverished community dealing with regular police repression. So they make the decision that they're going to engage in much more aggressive direct action against racism on campus. And the school president and the school provost, they're largely just sort of poo-pooing it and saying, pish posh, not a big deal. And then one student started to engage in a hunger strike right in the middle of campus, and it started to get a great deal of attention. And then a lot of students, particularly black women, it was black women, just putting it out there, went to the football team and said, he's killing himself to fight racism on this campus, and you're not doing anything. Like, you know, the football team at the University of Missouri at the time, 69% black, and the campus as a whole, 7%. And so saying, like, here's one institution where we actually have numbers and power. And it's like, what are you going to do about it? What are you willing to risk? And the football team, starting with the black athletes on the team, but it became the entire team, including an almost all-white coaching staff, all decided that they were not going to play until the issues of racism were addressed on campus. And immediately the situation goes from a school president and a school provost sort of like smiling and being like, oh, isn't that cute? Students are protesting, to the school losing $1 million a week because there's no college football. And then the provost and the president find themselves out of work within days. Sometimes I'll tell you something, Melissa, my hackles as a sports, I'll say an amateur sports historian, my hackles go up a big time when people talk about women being denied sports at the turn of the 20th century, because it was actually white women that didn't have sports. Black women organized their own leagues immediately. And there are huge articles in like the Chicago Defender and the Amsterdam News about black women's sports leagues that would be very highly attended. The Chicago Defender once did a poll of favorite athletes in the community, and over half of them were women. This was like at the turn of the 20th century. And so we forget that at our peril, and we have this incredible historical blindness because of the twin evils of racism and sexism about the roles that black women have played. And that's why, I mean, honestly, like, I'm not asking for a cookie, I swear, but when I did the book, it was very important to me to make sure that that representation was real, because the knee story is not a male story. You know, it's a story of people across sports and across genders wanting to be heard, because the revulsion towards police brutality, the revulsion towards racial inequity, that has touched people across the board. And that was represented in the streets in the summer of 2020, and it was represented in the athletic fields in the lead up to 2020.
As you talk about being something that mattered across genders, we are watching state legislators across the country introducing legislation to ban trans athletes from grade school sports, from high school sports. Just in terms of thinking about the ways that you have some athletes who are able to choose what it means to be political, so they're or to protest, so they're playing their sport, and then they take that knee, they put their body in a position that makes a statement. But there are these other athletes, and their bodies make a statement just by being their bodies.
This is going to be one of the great struggles going forward, because the anti-trans hysteria has become a staple of the right wing in this country, and they've tried different avenues, by which to demonize people for no reason other than them being their true selves. I mean, we remember first they tried bathrooms and, you know, it didn't really take like they dreamed, this mass demonization of the idea of the bathroom bill. And if anything, there was a terrific pushback against it, especially when it was pointed out that, you know, cisgender people are the people who have been committing sexual assaults in bathrooms. So it became some sort of thing like, oh, look, maybe we shouldn't talk about that because the mirror is on us now. But with sports, they feel like they have found purchase in a way to try to divide people and split people and put forward just yet another boogeyman of this idea of your child is being denied because someone else is trying to succeed. And isn't that the root of so much prejudice in our society, that idea of people trying to self-victimize for the purpose of oppressing somebody else? I mean, so much of modern racism is defined by that lens of self-victimization and then therefore justifying political or sometimes literal violence through an act of, and I want to, the word self is so important here, self-victimization, not real victimization, not the actuality of being victimized, but the idea of projecting that lens upon yourself so you can act outside the norms of society because you do it under the guise of saying, well, I'm defending my family, I'm doing that. We see that across so many political issues. And it's something we need to stand up against, particularly in the sports world, because the heart of the sports world should be about inclusion. And I recognize that the very nature of the history of sports in this country has been about the fight for inclusion, whether we're talking about Jackie Robinson, whether we're talking about Billie Jean King. The fight for inclusion has been the story of sports. And what we're learning is that it continues into the 21st century.
My last question for you. So when you were talking about that distinction between transactional and transformational, I was thinking that it's also true sometimes of relationships that journalists have with their sources. Sometimes they are truly just transactional, but I have known you long enough and seen you in relationship with many of the athletes that you have developed relationship with to know that you do not have a transactional relationship with the folks who you speak with and who help you and help all of us to understand the sports world. So it is with the sense of undoubtedly the depth with which you can answer this question that I ask, how is Colin Kaepernick doing right now?
Ah, well, Colin Kaepernick is somebody who's undergoing his own transformational project. We haven't really heard from him much at all over the last 5 years, but we're going to be hearing a lot from him in the next year. And he's going to be telling his story by his terms with the help of people like Ava DuVernay, and with the help of his own book publisher, which he started to speak about the issues that are dear to him, namely issues around police and prison reform, if not outright abolition. So we're going to hear a great deal from Colin Kaepernick in the next year, because I would argue that his transformation is really just beginning.
Dave Zirin, as always, thank you for bringing us voices and analysis and a certain kind of heart to thinking about sports and the world of sports. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation and author of The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Now, in the new Netflix series, High on the Hog, host and food writer Stephen Satterfield traces the history and significance of African-American foodways. The show is based on a book of the same name by the renowned historian and cookbook author, Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Are you familiar with the phrase High on the Hog?
Oh, yeah. Going back in the slavery days, hog was a big deal. Folks on the plantation would kill it for their master, but all they got was the parts of the hog, like the feet and the tail and the intestine.
Part culinary show, part travelogue, the four-episode docuseries follows Satterfield as he travels to West Africa and across the U.S. to bring audiences the stories of the Black people who've shaped U.S. food culture, past and present. The chefs, historians, preservationists, activists, and more.
When you understand your history mm-hmm. and understand where you come from, that mm-hmm. understanding gives you purpose.
We call our food soul food. We are the only people who named our cuisine after something invisible that you could feel, like love and God.
For more on the importance of a show like High on the Hog, we're joined now by Osai Endelin, a James Beard award-winning writer and co-author of The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Osai, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa.
So let's just dig right in. Why does this show have such, as you wrote in the New York Times, profound significance?
Well, that significance occurs on many levels, but that significance happens first just in the existence of this narrative itself. This history is not new, as viewers of the show have come to realize, of readers of Dr. Harris's work have known for quite some time, but we haven't seen it presented in this way. And that begs the question, why is that? And that starts to turn our attention toward the decision makers and the gatekeepers in the realm of media and entertainment, who get to decide just who it is that gets to be on planes and boats traveling to far off lands, explaining to American audiences what food is important or interesting or curious and what cultures are worthy of closer looks. And that hasn't really ever been a privilege extended to Black people or Black creators, not necessarily with the kinds of budgets that we're accustomed to seeing in other travelogues. So I felt that it was important to articulate that the timing of this story is important, not just because of what is happening in African American history right now, but because of how long it has taken for us to get such a core element of our history portrayed in such a clear and artistic and beautiful way.
It really is beautiful. And I have to say there's this one portion, one storytelling that just had me screaming and hollering and jumping in my living room as I was watching it. And it's really the story of James Hemings. And I've taught that for a lot of years as part of kind of, you know, my courses in American politics. But can you tell us a little bit about the story of James Hemings?
Yes, and you know, I'll have to say the one of the best people to consult for that is Adrian Miller, who wrote a beautiful book called The President's Kitchen Cabinet that details the experiences and the history of Black people in and around the White House throughout our nation's history. And he's in two episodes of High on the Hog. But James Hemings was a chef who was trained in France. And he was an enslaved chef who worked for Thomas Jefferson. And it is through the training that he received in France and his own innovations and creativity and craftsmanship that he brought back to the United States that he helped establish the fine dining culture that, you know, we have come to understand as being uniquely Eurocentric and aspirationally American. It is, in fact, many Black people who have been part and parcel of forming that legacy for us. And that in itself is surprising to many people, but not to folks who perhaps have been closely watching the restaurant industry over the last couple of centuries.
And for me, it also it's part of connecting back to your point around sort of who has the budget to travelogue, right? I was also thinking if you go to Mount Rushmore, you know, there's like a little plaque that will tell you Thomas Jefferson created ice cream. Not Jefferson, right? Right. We need to go to Hemings, right? So it's always about asking that question behind. And I think that's part of what I find fascinating about High on the Hog is that it actually doesn't start with enslavement here in the U.S. It begins in West Africa, in Benin. And for those who haven't watched the series yet, why does it matter to begin there in West Africa?
It matters because that's where our ancestors originated from. And when you understand that these human beings brought with them traditions and practices and cultures that were already well in existence, you understand that they took what they already had and made the best that they could with what they were offered, which wasn't very much, you know, upon arrival to what eventually became the United States. And that's a point that gets missed, in a way that I think is so prohibitive to all students of this history, because it robs us both of an understanding that the continent of Africa lost something too in the transatlantic slave trade. You know, in modern times, we might call that a brain drain, you know, if you work for a tech company. But there's an incredible loss of resources, of intergenerational presence that happened on that side too. And of course, the colonial impact in Africa is still incredibly harmful and damaging. One of the things I really like about High on the Hog is that it also articulates that the culture in Benin and in neighboring countries, as you might surmise, is not static, and that those culinary voices are changing and adapting as well. So as much as you have people still trying to make the food of their grandparents and their great-grandparents, they're also taking the experiences and the influences of different cultures and travel experiences that they're doing to affect their cuisine and what they want to put on the table, just as people here are saying, you know, I'm not only going to cook with the ingredients that are available in my backyard. I want to incorporate the experiences that I had in Japan or the experiences that I had in Brazil in the food that you're having here, which if you are of African descent, becomes a lot easier to do and to connect those dots once you understand the movement of Black people throughout the diaspora, because where we go, our food went too.
My one advice for folks who are watching this series is be sure you've got some food in the house to cook, because it is going to make you hungry. Moving from all the way from James Hemmings to Michael Twitty, it gives us that intergenerational look. Thank you so much, Osai Endelin. James Beard, award-winning writer and co-author of The Rise, Black Cooks and the Soul of American Food. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And we just heard how the Netflix series High on the Hog brought the stories of Black people who have shaped U.S. food culture past and present to a mainstream audience. And it turns out there's a lot of appetite right now in recognizing and celebrating Black foodways and culinary traditions. That's something our next guest knows very well. Chef, activist, and educator Bryant Terry is the author of the new book, Black Food, and editor-in-chief of Four Color Books. Featuring the work of more than 100 contributors, Black Food explores Black foodways across the U.S. and around the world through recipes, poetry, essays, art, and more. Chef Terry is best known for his vegan and vegetarian spin on African-American cuisine, so I asked him what we really mean when we say Black food today.
I guess I should start by talking about what I've been pushing back against the past two decades that I've been working around health, food, and farming issues. And it's this very reductive way that people often imagine or talk about or write about Black food. And when people hear that term, I think they think of one of two things. I often hear people refer to the kind of antebellum survival foods upon which many enslaved Africans had to rely. But one, we know that before 1865, there were free Blacks, so we weren't all enslaved. And the institution of slavery wasn't a monolith, and where there might have been, you know, more paternalistic ways of enslaved Africans being kind of fed. That's, let's say, the Black Belt, you know, in parts of the coastal Carolinas or the Caribbean or the, you know, Louisiana. The institution could look different depending on the disposition of the plantation owner, their financial status. So there are a number of factors that might influence the way that enslaved Africans or Black folks in general were cooking and eating. So to simply call it slave food, which I hear many people referring to our cuisine, I don't want to eat, that's just slave food. And you know, vilifying it, I think is wrongheaded and historically inaccurate. But the other thing that people think about when they hear Black food is soul food. And when people hear soul food or say that, what they are most often imagining are the big flavored meats, the overcooked vegetables, and the sugary desserts that one might find at a soul food restaurant. And I'm not denying that either of those things. They're subsets of a larger and richer, diverse and complex African-American cuisine or culinary traditions. And what I want people to do is understand that diversity and complexity and move beyond the stereotypes. And, you know, if you just think about just looking at African-American cuisine, you know, the traditional staples of our cuisine, like you're talking about nutrient rich mustards and collards and turnips and kale and, you know, things like tubers like sweet potatoes and sugar snap peas and pole beans and black eyed peas. Like these are the foundations of what I think many people would say should be a healthful and nutrient dense diet. So I want people to have a more diverse and complex understanding of what our food is. And you can't talk about African American cuisine without looking at the diaspora and understanding that, you know, the foods that traveled from West and Central Africa to the New World and melding with the indigenous foods and flavor profiles and ingredients of this country or this land and, you know, the influence of European cuisine. So I like to think of, you know, African-American cuisine is the original modern global fusion cuisine.
I need to pause for a second. I'm so disrupted. Are you saying that like white kids in Brooklyn didn't discover kale?
Yeah. And they didn't, you know, the funny thing when you say that is not just kale, but it's interesting to me that even something like, you know, chitlins or chitterlings, depending on how you want to describe it, like the way in which Black folks would often be made fun of because of eating animal innards. And now you go to some fancy hipster restaurant and you pay like $30 for some chitterlings or whatever they might call them. So yeah, you know, I think it just kind of in line with the anti-Blackness that I see just that kind of permeates the society where it's like people just feel like they need to denigrate our traditions and our culture. And I'm here to say that we need to be uplifting it. You know, I think when we talk about criteria for healthful eating, we often focus on nutrients and micronutrients. And one thing that I think is often missing from that conversation are, you know, cultural foods. And I think that, you know, one of the keys to Black liberation is us embracing our cultural foods, consuming them, cooking them, and, you know, building community around those foods.
So what are other frameworks we could have as Black folks for building community around food?
When you ask that question, the first thing I think about is the activism that I've been involved in for the past two decades around building a more healthful and just and sustainable food system and understanding that, you know, when we think about, you know, issues with many historically more marginalized communities, many of them being working class and working poor Black communities, being devoid of healthy, fresh, affordable and culturally appropriate food. You know, so often what I've seen is this idea that you need some type of outsiders to come in and help fix this problem, you know, whether it's philanthropic organizations or, I don't know, well-meaning white folks who don't come from the community. And, you know, I'm not saying that folks can't be supportive and help efforts in communities to ensure that everyone has access to the human right of fresh, healthy, and affordable and culturally appropriate food. But, you know, I always think about the reality that the people who are living in the most impacted communities are the experts. They know the problems that they face. They often have very inventive solutions to addressing those problems and overcoming those barriers, whether it's physical, economic, geographic, but people need power and resources shifted into those communities. And so I've always been invested in helping build power in communities. And I found that one of the most powerful ways to start those conversations and help people feel more invested in doing that work is starting with the food, you know, not starting with the heady intellectual ideas or the public policy, but actually building community around table, giving people opportunities to care for each other and break bread, and then, you know, using that as a site for strategizing. I mean, look, you know, some of the most powerful organizing that was done during the American Civil Rights Movement was done in kitchens and restaurants and homes around table. You know, so many of the aunties and grandmothers and mothers were feeding these revolutionaries. And so I see the table as a powerful site for like literally feeding ourselves, but, you know, feeding the revolution as well.
I have a couple of sort of more let's call it more grounded questions about some of this. So the first is a couple of years back, I really threw myself into this and really started farming my backyard with everything from, you know, a fairly intensive size, you know, flock of poultry and with, you know, all of my many, many, many raised beds across the acres, which have gotten a little out of control. But here's one of the things I experienced. Man, growing your own food is hard. It is hard. It's hard. It really is actually hard. And I just mean the amount of work, time, energy, love. And sometimes I'm so tired from farming, I don't cook. Talk to me about what it means. How do we think about the ways that we engage with food in these multiple levels? I love having my hands in the dirt, but I hate being too tired to make my own food at the end of the day.
Not to say that this is happening for you, but I think that capitalism often convinces us that we need to address problems on our own. We need to pull ourselves mm-hmm. up by our bootstraps and we need to just fix this problem. And I think that, you know, we can look at multiple areas, but when it comes to feeding ourselves, growing food, building thriving local food systems, these are things that I think it's important for us to be engaging in these practices with community. Let's just talk about cooking itself. We could talk about the, you know, your farming and urban homesteading, but, you know, a lot of people will cite the time intensity or the labor intensity or the cost of, you know, making meals from scratch and feeding oneself good food and not, you know, going out and buying processed and packaged foods. And so people feel like it's a lot, you know, with our busy lives and, you know, many people are working more than one job because the job that they were working isn't paying a living wage. And so, you know, I paint a picture for people and I say, imagine this, what if rather than you doing that all alone, what if, you know, people in your neighborhood or family members or whatever community you're part of decide to collectively do it. And everyone gets up early on a Saturday morning, you go to that local farmer's market in town and, you know, you posse up and even before going to shop, how about you do some menu planning and decide what ingredients we're going to be purchasing? And then after we get the food, we go back to the person who has the nice chef's kitchen and lots of room for us all to be cooking and preparing. And, you know, somebody makes a soup, another person makes a casserole, somebody makes a big vat of tea. You can have a week's worth of delicious, freshly made, local, seasonal, sustainable, yummy food that you can freeze some of it and you put some away. And guess what? You're building community. You're connecting with people that you love. You're supporting the people who are growing our food with integrity and care for the earth and care for communities. So I think the short answer is that we need to build community. And while we're building a better food system for ourselves and our family, we should be building community and lifting each other up in the process.
I love that response. Now, one more question. Talk to me about cookbooks and where they fit in our contemporary moment of how we cook and download quick recipes. I still do love and have some pretty sticky page cookbooks from years and years of returning to them. But how do we think about or how should we be thinking about cookbooks within this community building of food?
Well, first of all, unfortunately, our industrialized food system and our capitalist society creates conditions where oftentimes people don't have the time and the space to practice cooking. And so even over the pandemic, you know, it's interesting. Cookbooks did extremely well. You know, my book, Vegetable Kingdom, came out the beginning of 2020. And then the pandemic hit, my tour was canceled. And I was like, oh, it's done. That book is going to disappear. But, you know, people were invested in practicing more home cooking. And I think that cookbooks are important because it provides a lot of the fundamental skills that I think many of us are lacking. You know, a couple of generations ago, when we were spending lots of time, you know, I learned early on many of the kind of cooking techniques and preserving and canning and pickling from my grandmother. And so I recognize that, you know, oftentimes that's just not something that people are able to tap into. And so I, as an educator, as a community organizer, as someone who's invested in raising people's food IQ, see my cookbooks as a way of empowering people to have the fundamentals of cooking. I mean, look, I may run myself out of business by saying this, but I actually think that you know, cookbooks should you be used as a guide. I think the magic of cooking is spontaneity, creativity, you know, and the kind of spirit of jazz, like working within a structure, but improvising and using that Swiss chard that you have at home, even though the recipe calls for collard greens, or, you know, if you don't do dairy and the recipe calls for milk, make use some cashew cream and substitute it for that, or use coconut milk. So I think books can be useful, but I don't want people to rely on books, because I think that the soul, the spirit, the excitement of cooking comes from just being in the flow.
Just because we're coming up on the holiday, or holidays, what's a go-to fall dish that is going to be on your holiday community table this year?
My oldest daughter, Mila, has become I was going to say militant, but I'm not going to say that. She's become a dedicated vegan over the past year. It's been really beautiful, because I was very clear. I didn't want to force her to adopt a particular dietary model, because I've seen that go terribly wrong and kids kind of rebelling. And I just modeled, and it's been really beautiful seeing her embrace, you know, vegan eating and a lifestyle, because she's clear that it's not just for the health reasons, but she can cite the economic reasons. This girl's 10 years old. And so she inspires me, but lots of our eating in our home has been driven by what she wants to do. So we, you know, can encourage her to continue to grow and learn as a chef. And her favorite book these days, I have to just shout out this book. It's called The Korean Vegan. And we have been pretty much cooking out of that book since we got it. And she said that we will be having Korean holiday meals, because that's what she wants to cook.
I love it. I love it. And is she's your oldest, you said?
She's our oldest, yes.
All right. And she's 10. That means she still likes you and is. So when she starts eating barbecue ribs, just like in front of you at 14, just know that it's going to be all right. She's going to come back round. I'm just, as the mom of a 19-year-old and the auntie of some 30 and 20 somethings, I'm just saying there comes a moment when they rebel, but then they come right on back.
Ooh, I needed that reassurance. Thank you.
Chef, I so appreciate you and this conversation. Chef Bryant Terry, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Melissa. It was an honor.
Okay, folks, that's the show. Thanks for being with us today. Whether you celebrate Thanksgiving or not, we here at The Takeaway wish you all a safe and happy holiday filled with joy. And don't forget, you don't only have to listen to us on the radio. You can also subscribe to our podcast. It's available wherever you get your audio. Remember, find The Takeaway, subscribe, like, and share away. You can also head on over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us with your show ideas or your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Catch y'all tomorrow.